This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
Hello, welcome to the show. This is Emotional Badass, where Moxie meets Mindful. I'm your host, Nikki Eisenhower, life coach and psychotherapist. And on today's episode, I'm discussing 10 strategies for highly sensitive people, survivors, and people in recovery. So in my work, I speak to people who come from dysfunction and want a life that is functional and light, purposeful, fulfilling, and as peaceful as possible. Those of us who grew up in chaos may want those things and struggle to grow into peace when what we know is chaos. Here are simple and random tips. These might feel really random, beyond the typical, for highly sensitive people and survivors that are recovering. Now, why beyond the typical? Well, I trust that all of you listening know the basics. You might not be doing them, but you know them. You know that meditation is good medicine for all of us. You know that we need to get as much sleep as we can reasonably. We know that we don't need to be eating crap if we want to feel the best that we can feel. These basics, they're an important foundation. They're easy to toss out. They're easy to dismiss. They're easy to kind of get lost in the hustle bustle of modern Western life, where we are so overscheduled. We are so frazzled and overdoing in so many different arenas. So here we go. If you want to talk more about this list that I'm about to give you, if you want to discuss it, come hang out on Patreon and you can share your opinions, share your insights, share what you're working on in our discussion post underneath this release. And while you're there, come enjoy our commercial-free episodes that are available on Patreon, as well as our exclusive content that you can't find anywhere else. All right, here's number one. Believe in and grow your goodness. Now, what do I mean by that? Believe in and grow your goodness. If you grew up with a lot of chaos, if you grew up with toxic or inadequate parenting, what's likely is that you had a lot of blame and shame pointed at you. Most highly sensitive people are naturally overly responsible. And that's as unhealthy as being under-responsible, having too little responsibility for our own emotional stuff, for our own flaws as human beings, for the mistakes that we all make as human beings who relate to other people. Highly sensitive people have a propensity to carry too much responsibility, often because they come from families that don't hold their responsibility. It's as if our little psyches are born into these family systems and look around and discover, nobody's maturely having personal responsibility here. I know, I'll fix it by having all the responsibility. Psychologically, we like to take it on. If it's me, if it's my fault, if I'm to blame, then psychologically, some part of me knows, okay, I can do something about that. I can change that. I can fix that. To have to sit in the reality that I can't change my family members. I can't make them be personally responsible. I can't live life and get out of survival mode if I'm carrying the responsibility for other people on top of the responsibility to myself. So very often when I work with a client, clients will think that they are toxic. Why? They've been told they're toxic by people who don't take responsibility. It's a projection of somebody else's toxicity. And from that place of over-responsibility, I see the highly sensitive person very often go, uh-oh, it must be me. I need to work on me. And that's important, but it can't be overdone. So what I'm advocating for here is to believe in and grow your goodness. If you genuinely and honestly work to own your faults, your mistakes, and work to move forward in life, not mindlessly repeating hurtful things to yourself or to other people, then you're not toxic. Toxic people don't work on themselves. Toxic people blame and shame without owning their part. Toxic people feel righteous. They don't open to learning from other people. They wouldn't learn from me, a toxic person, because in their mind, they're better than me. They know more than me. And I couldn't possibly have any insights into them. They're not interested in learning in this way, the way highly sensitive people tend to crave and are seekers. So believe in and grow your goodness. If you work on yourself genuinely, that kind of makes you a good person. Do you really need more than that? Believe in your goodness for your grown-up parts as well as for your inner child. We can all do better. You get to believe in and grow your goodness. Number two, tend to your body and don't overvalue your thoughts. Now, this might puzzle you. For many, many, many years, it puzzled me. I spoke to therapists when I was in graduate school. I had professors that were awesome. They were brilliant. But I didn't quite understand how important being present in my body was to my recovery process, was for me to get out of survival mode and into thriving mode. So many highly sensitive people are so heady. They live in their heads. They are disembodied. Now, if I look at childhood trauma, childhood chaos, parents that argue a lot, parents that were scary to kids, lots of sense of lack as if we were about to go hungry or the power was going to be turned off all the time. That constant tension. See, we all have intuitions when something is wrong or off or dangerous or unsafe. And when we grow up in homes that have such unsafety, such overstimulation for a little being, what happens is our little selves, if I speak in I statements, might be helpful here. My little girl self, if she saw my mother, like at 5 or 6 years old, punch a hole in the wall, something I saw quite a bit growing up, my intuition knew, warning, warning, something is wrong here. Moms aren't supposed to do this. This doesn't feel safe. This doesn't feel right. What am I supposed to do with myself? And in the absence of her being able to soothe me, every parent loses it. Really good, solid, healthy parents lose it sometimes. This is not about being perfect. This is about not having someone to step in the moments where we're frightened or overwhelmed. If I had a very plugged in adult to step in, they might say, Nikki, come here as a little girl. Come sit in my lap. Sometimes moms get really upset. And moms aren't perfect people and they make mistakes. Moms shouldn't punch the wall like that. I'm sorry you had to see that. That must have been scary. Then I would have had an outlet, like steam coming off of a pressure cooker. We have things that build up, pressures, tensions that build up when we're little and we're in chaos. So what happens in the absence of having a safe, grounded, mature person to hold our hand and guide us through? My little self, maybe your little self too, would witness something that was dysfunctional, feel that in my gut. But because I was little, I couldn't get in my car and drive away. I couldn't stand up for myself and verbalize, hey, I don't want to be around this energy. This isn't good for me. I'm going to take myself elsewhere because I didn't have the autonomy to do so. So what happens is we feel these feelings and we can't do anything about it when we're little. And so that feeling doesn't have anywhere to go except to our heads. And this is where so many highly sensitive people begin the pattern of something happening in the moment, having a gut intuition, uh-oh, this isn't right. And the pattern was started in childhood to not act for ourselves, but to go to our heads. So many highly sensitive people overthink themselves into a circle, into a hole. And because this overthinking is a strong childhood pattern, and what does psychotherapy do? It has us talking and talking and thinking and thinking and thinking and thinking. So what we do in recovery is we recognize this and we start realizing, oh, wow, I am in my head a lot, too much. It gives me headaches. It gives me anxiety. I worst case scenario. So how do we manage that? Not with more thinking so much, by tending to our bodies and not overvaluing our thoughts. Our thoughts are important. Our thoughts need to be as healthy as they can be. We got to watch that critical voice. But tending to our bodies is a different thing than thinking thoughts in our headspace. Tending to your body means stopping and taking a breath so that your body isn't just going, running on tension, running on adrenaline, if that's what your body learned how to do as a child. Mine certainly did. Healing in this regard is teaching this body, this human system, everything that I am, everything that you are, to balance more by being in the body and not just spinning out in the head. So how do we tend to our body? You start by noticing it. What's your body doing right now? Are you tense in any areas for no reason other than it's a pattern? Take a deep breath and invite those areas to soften right now. Often, highly sensitive people working with a therapist who gives such therapeutic advice to trauma survivors, it's as if the trauma survivor hears it and goes, yeah, that makes sense. And then leaves the office and just continues that pattern of thinking. I don't want you to think about tending to your body. I want you to actually stop thinking and tend to your body. Don't have another thought. Just take a deep breath. We are robbed from our natural birthright of calm and peace when we're raising too much tension and stress. Tending to your body brings you back to this birthright. Number three, some of you will recognize this if you've worked with me in some of my coursework. Light up for yourself. Now, that's an easy thing to sound like a throwaway kind of psychobabble. What does it mean to light up for yourself? There's a video I show whenever I teach boundaries. And it's Oprah and Toni Morrison having a discussion. Toni Morrison is a Southern world-renowned writer. I grew up reading her. She feels very maternal to me. And she's talking about, in that video that I share, that she realized when her children were small that her kids would come in the room and she would look at them with a critical eye. Are your pants buckled? Is your hair right? Is your shirt tucked in the right way? And she realized how that registered to her children, that they would look down and kind of pat themselves and go, what's wrong? What's wrong with me? And when someone looks at us with that critical eye, it's natural to look down at ourselves and wonder, what's wrong with me? Is something wrong with me? She said she realized in that moment that she wanted her eyes, her face, to speak what her heart felt, instead of that critical eye. And from that moment on, she would light up. She would beam for them when they came in the room. Now, 5 minutes later, she might say, hey, buckle your pants. Let's fix your hair. If you grew up with unsafe, dysfunction, immature, or toxic parenting, you likely didn't have adults lighting up for you, or at least not lighting up consistently. Or not lighting up with healthiness. Some people may be abused, and that abuser may light up for them. That might be part of the grooming that allows for such abuse. It is essential that you learn how to light up for yourself. It's essential that you learn how to wear on your face what your heart wants. And it's okay to fake it till you make it here. I want to challenge you, if you're resonating with what I'm saying, go look in the mirror. And when you look in the mirror, put down that critical eye. Don't look at your blemishes, any bags under your eyes, any wrinkles that are forming. Look at the essence of who you are and light up for her, light up for him. This is an essential part of reparenting. Healthy parents beam when their children come in. They don't give their children this attitude and this energy like, ugh, this thing that needs something from me. What do you want now? It's the energy I got from my mom. If anything, she would dim when she would see me. So what a soothing balm in my recovery process to give myself permission and then to actually do it, to light up for myself. What would happen in your life if you prioritized lighting up for yourself? And some of you moms and dads out there will hear this and you will just start lighting up for your kids. One of the codependent check-ins to see if you're acting from codependence is, are you giving away what you most need for yourself? And so many parents make the mistake of trying to heal themselves by giving their children this idyllic childhood. As you raise children, if you come from such dynamics, I want you to know my philosophy. You don't have to own it. You don't have to agree to it. You don't have to buy into it. But if you just give it all away to your kids, your inner child is going to be so bitter because your inner child is going to watch you give away what he or she has been craving for a lifetime. I encourage the parents that work with me to give to their children in such a way, but to also know that every moment that they give to their children, they're invited to give to their own inner child. And of course, that's going to feel awkward. Of course, that's going to feel weird. Of course, you're going to hear the critical voice go, this is some BS, psychobabble stuff. Are we really going to do this? Really? Like you're a little kid? That critical voice will creatively and masterfully push you away from what could help you lighten your load, feel brighter, feel easier in this life, entertain thriving mode while letting go of survival.
Have you ever wished that you had a direct line to your pediatrician to ask them all the questions that constantly crop up while parenting? Well, we hear you, and we have been there too. That's why we launched the Bites of Health podcast. Every morning, we'll answer a commonly asked pediatric question in 5 minutes or less. You can tune in while you're making your second cup of coffee or from the school drop-off line. Who are we? I'm Dr. Jess Steyer, a public health scientist and also co-host of the Unbiased Science podcast. Every day, I'll chat with one or both of your new pediatrician besties, Dr. Dina DiMaggio, a general pediatrician, and Dr. Anthony Porto, a pediatric gastroenterologist. We'll talk about all the things related to our kids' health, from dealing with a colicky infant to navigating puberty in the teenage years. So be sure to tune in to Bites of Health, now live on all podcast platforms.
Number four, lighten your load. So I just said light up for you in number three. Now I'm saying lighten your load. There very well may be some themes of lightening and everything that that means in our recovery process. Lighten your load. How do we do this? I'm sure some of you are hearing this going, tell me, Nikki, I will love to lighten my load. Consider the family dynamics that you come from the same way you might clean out a closet to lighten your load. So here's what I mean. If we clean out a closet, most of us are familiar with this strategy now. We kind of have three piles, right? The gems that we want to keep, the straight up trash that is going straight in the bin, and the things that no longer serve me, but may serve someone else and I may donate. I may give away. I may let go. Because what doesn't work for me or never did may work well for somebody else, but not for me. So we want to look at our family dynamics in a similar way as cleaning out the closet. There is so much from my family dynamic that I wanted to end with me in my lifetime. The amount of shaming I grew up with, the amount of sweeping things under the rug, those things have gone out in the trash for me. I've also kept some treasures. I have tremendous work ethic from my family of origin. I have tremendous integrity to try to do the right thing. Doesn't mean I always succeed. Doesn't mean I don't put my foot in my mouth or trip up sometimes. But then I try to own it and clean it up to the best of my ability. And I get that straight from my grandparents. Those are treasures to me. What might I donate and give away? My hard-earned wisdom. I think that's part of what this show is. Not just this episode, everything that I put out. It's me paying it forward. It's me making something useful out of something that wasn't. What treasures do you want to hold on to? And what is trash that you can let go of? And what can you pay forward? Donate. Get rid of that way. Make it useful for someone else. But get it out and away from you, a clearing. If you feel heavy, if you feel like you're dragging resentment, if you're dragging pain forward, if you're telling yourself that the right way to live is to have an entire iron suit of armor so that nobody can hurt you again, how do you thrive while you wear armor? How do you go swimming while you're wearing armor? How do you laugh at jokes dragging around this clunky shield and sword? Life will not just magically lighten your load. Please don't sit back and passively cross your fingers and just hope that life somehow gets easier. You get to psychologically, mentally, and emotionally lighten your load. That's the real power we have, to internally lighten our load no matter what is happening in our external experience. Number 5, accept who you are and embrace what makes you different. Now, we have all heard this type of advice all across our lives, right? We need to accept who we are. We need to embrace our differences. But what does that actually functionally mean as highly sensitive people, as people who are recovering and seeking a better life? Highly sensitive people tend to have a real love-hate relationship with their sensitivity. I call it the beauty and the burden. And it really is on each of us individually to not fight who we are, or to not fight the things about ourselves that really aren't very changeable. There is no way that I could ever be a less feeling person. Can you feel that for me in the way that I talk, in the way that I share? If you're watching me on YouTube, in what comes across by visually seeing me, by auditorily hearing my voice, making ourselves less sensitive isn't it. Embracing our sensitivity and working with it is an acceptance of who we are. Whether we believe we were born into this sensitivity and or intensified our sensitivity because of our life experience. Either way, here we are, sensitive beings. So if I'm looking at a sunrise or a sunset, I might tear up. If I'm with other people that look at me and go, "Why are you crying? What's wrong with you?" If I am in acceptance of who I really am, I won't feel anxious. I won't feel judged. I will stand on my own 2 feet in the power of my self-acceptance and the power of my self-love and own who I am. The beauty of this sunrise moves me to tears. And I love that about me. Sensitive people walk the world really desperately wanting other people to accept their sensitivities, and then they will. It doesn't work like that, y'all. The more that I step into owning my sensitivity, the more I teach everyone I come into contact with that what's on the table is accepting my sensitivity, because I already do. It's an invitation more like, "Hey, would you like to get on board with this if we are to relate to each other?" And if they say no, I'm likely not going to let us relate to each other very long. Self-acceptance versus outward approval is key to us really acting and being in self-love. Number 6, except that friends aren't cheap and they're not easily replaceable. Friends are like gems, y'all. Absolute gems. Those of you leaning extroverted, we think about 30% of highly sensitive people are extroverted. So the extroverted, highly sensitive people that are out there, you may hold on to more people than an introverted HSP over a lifetime, and that's totally okay. But social media has subconsciously cheapened what the word friendship means, what friend means, how we relate to one another. Friends are not cheap. Friends are not the people you have on Facebook. Real true friends for a highly sensitive person, for someone who has had dark nights of the soul, who has been to hell and back and wants to thrive, our true friends are like soulmates. I have some male friends that are like big brothers to me. They soothe that part of my soul that craved having an older brother when I was a child. My closest girlfriend I met right when I turned 18. We'll tell each other we are each other's true sisters in this life. For someone that is estranged from her biological sisters, this is important. This is powerful. This is soul soothing. I have a gift of a bond with her that I trust to be intact till the end of our lives. And I don't say that lightly. I've had a few female friends over the years that I hoped and thought would fit the same kind of longevity in my life, and they fizzled. Having friends means allowing a certain amount of risk because we don't know if those friends are loyal until we see a loyalty. We don't know if our friends feel a depth of connection to us the way we might feel a depth of connection to other people. Just by being who I am out in the world, I hold up a pretty strong mirror to other people. All of us do as highly sensitive people, and not everyone will like the mirrors that we hold up. Despite the times that I've felt let down or discarded, friendships have fallen apart, I've never wanted to let that pain, that hurt, even feelings of betrayal, convince me that the risk of vulnerability, the possibility of getting hurt in the future, I didn't want to shut myself down to the possibility of making a new friend, the possibility of having someone amazing, a gem, another soulmate grace my life. Consider where you are in the risk and reward of friendship. Based on various statistics that have come out for the last few years, we are living through an epidemic of loneliness. People feel isolated. More people are working at home instead of in an office or outside of the home than ever before. Politics has pushed separating from people, divisiveness because of difference. If you're more of a loner, you get to accept that. Even the most loner out there, the biggest loners that can be, we still need some other people. We're biologically wired to be tribal. Maybe a smaller tribe, maybe a bigger tribe. If you want more reward in your relationships, does that mean more risk? And how are you supporting yourself walking towards such a risk? Do you frighten yourself or encourage yourself? Do you doomsday? Nobody's worth it. Or do you ground yourself and say, I am looking for a gem? The truth is, finding friends for me has felt a lot like going to a Goodwill and being determined to find a really cool outfit. It's probably there, but boy, am I going to have to work to find it. Don't let the fact that friendships can take work turn you off to the possibility of friendship. Number 7, this is a mantra I've used at different times in my life to help me realize that my fear in the moment wasn't necessarily about the present moment. And this is an idea to really sit with, maybe have a conversation or a little journal session with yourself. What if everything that scares me the most, I've already survived? Now, we live with modern news cycles, right? We can get scared about almost anything. Things that could happen to us, things that could happen in the world, it's pretty easy. But when we really look at the things that really shake us to our core, really sort of haunt us, we can look back and ask ourselves, are these things I've already survived? Everything that scares me the most, I've already survived. This is a statement of empowerment. This is a statement of self-cheerleading, of showing up for yourself with a message that you are a survivor. What does it feel like if I say to you in this moment, your past is over? It could never, ever happen today like it did in the past. Does that ring true for you? It can't be recreated. You can use my life and my story to see that. I will never, ever, ever again be as vulnerable as the little girl that I was. So when I feel a wave of old fear, my mindfulness has been trained to observe that, to step in and go, wait a minute, Nikki, is this an old fear your body is just used to feeling that washed over you? Are you scared of something that's already over and done? This is essential to understand so that we're not accidentally, as we try to take care of ourselves, dragging the past into our present. We learn from our greatest pains, but we also learn that we have to let them go. What if everything that scares me the most, I've already survived? I'm going to be excited to look at the Patreon discussion and see if this rings true for y'all. Know that you can replace your fears with accomplishment. What an idea, huh? What have you already survived? What have you already figured out? What is your hard-earned wisdom that you get to own that carries you forward? Will you allow yourself to carry the hard-earned wisdom forward or the pain and the fear? It really is on you to decide. Number 8. Learn to ride the waves of emotion without doing or deciding anything. Y'all, I could do probably 1,800 shows on this topic. So many sensitive people have told me over the years, how do you have your feelings? Okay, how do you just sit and be with yourself? And that is such a sad commentary on how uncomfortable humanity is in general at this point in modern life of just being still and feeling some stuff. My goodness, can we overcomplicate this as sensitive people? This is part of why so many of my clients wind up laughing with me. Are you really helping me work to do less, to get still, to just sit in one spot and feel something? Yeah. Yeah, very often. Because this is one of those things that we don't realize we're being trained out of if we grew up in an abusive home. I couldn't safely sit in my emotions. It's part of why I believe my abuse memories were genuinely, clinically repressed. That I could be abused at night and wake up in the morning foggy with no real recollection of what happened to me. And then get my books together and get myself dressed and fix my hair and go to school. So in our recovery, in our adulthoods, we're learning what it is to ride the waves of emotion. See, toddlers know how to do this. If anything is perfect on this earth, y'all know I rally against perfectionism, but if anything is actually truly perfect on this earth, it is the way a baby or a toddler moves through emotion. If a sweet little toddler boy falls and scrapes his knee, what does he do? Little two-year-old. He is going to wail. He is going to cry. He's going to have those big old giant tears just leaking down his little sweet face. And you know when he's going to stop crying? You know when he's going to stop emoting? When he's done. And the moment he's done, he's going to wipe his little face, maybe getting a hug from some adult that loves him and is watching him. And then he's going to, with that little quivery lip, take a deep breath and go back onto the playground to play. See, children that age don't let their thoughts rob them of their emotional process and experience. They just plop down on that little diaper booty and have their feelings until they're done. Because the world hasn't twisted their relationship with feeling and releasing emotion yet. See, they haven't learned. They haven't been on the planet long enough to start crying and have most people respond with, why are you crying? Stop crying. Don't do that. Just because they don't know what to do with their own emotions, seeing someone else cry. Learn to ride the waves of emotion without doing or deciding anything. See, anxiety wants to do a thing. So when we start feeling anxiety, very often our thoughts start racing. And we just want to do a thing. We want to eat a thing. We want to take a bath. We want to go for a run. We want to tell somebody off. Like, we just want to do a thing. It's as if our psychology goes, if I just do a thing, then I'll do a different thing. And by doing that different thing, I will eventually feel different. Okay, that's what will take care of my anxiety, right? I mean, it is the worst possible moment to feel anxious into panicking and start trying to decide things and doing things. Do you see how that is probably not so wise, but we all might feel that inclination, feel that pressure. You know, that's not a moment to be like, I'm ending this relationship. It's not a moment to quit your job. It's not a moment to engage with your boss that you don't get along with. Learn to ride the waves of emotion without doing or deciding anything. That means if you're sad, sitting and going, I'm sad. I'm just sad. And I have to watch the parts of me that try to overthink and do a thing. And I say out loud to myself, no, I'm just sad. I just need to be sad until I'm not. Pulling in that wisdom of the toddlers and the babies. There's nothing to do except ride the waves of emotion. When we are less emotional, we can decide some things. We can do some things. But at the height of emotion, if there's anything to do, it's breathe and be. And that's plenty. Number 9, accept who your parents were, who they are today, and what is likely at the end of their lives. All right, why am I throwing this one in there? There is an epidemic going on in our country that I haven't really heard anybody else acknowledge. I'm sure somebody is out there, but I haven't heard it. Most of my clients are dealing with parents, different dysfunction levels, but are dealing with parents who have done little to nothing towards their own health and wellness. And as they age, it is getting very, very hard collectively as a society for younger people to manage what's going on with the health of their parents. I watch a lot of highly sensitive people run into a lot of codependency, a lot of trying to control for the greater good. Sensitive people often have a gift of prophecy. That's the best description, the best language I've ever come up with. The gift of prophecy. What does that mean? I don't mean that we're quite psychic. I mean, we really have a propensity to understand and to see, to visualize the dominoes that are stacked up for the future. And if these dominoes fall, what the end result is, we very much try to prevent future problem. I think this is a universal, highly sensitive trait. Because we're sensitive, we're also aware that the moves that we make now in this moment are going to culminate in something in the future. And so we make decisions and we make moves in our lives to minimize drama, to minimize chaos if we are walking towards health. So of course we want to do that for the people we love. And of course that sense of taking care of someone else gets stronger and stronger if we're aware that they might not be doing so hot taking care of themselves. So what I keep encouraging my clients to do is to really accept who their parents were, who they are today, and what is likely at the end of their lives. For parents who have had a very chaotic life all of their lives, they live in chaos. Please help your inner child accept that they will likely end their lives in chaos too. It's the kind of thing we're not supposed to say out loud in polite society that very few people acknowledge. I remember asking my Italian grandfather, as a very little girl, I was in the swimming pool. He was holding me and I was playing with the necklace, the gold necklace he wore. And I just very innocently, I was probably 5 or 6, said, when you die, can I have your necklace? Very sweetly. Again, in that innocence of a child where we haven't learned yet what we're not supposed to say, what ideas make people uncomfortable and therefore to, in a people-pleasing way, shut up. I hadn't learned that yet. But I certainly learned it in the next moments that he shamed me. He responded to that request by saying, "You do not talk about someone dying ever. That is mean." It broke my heart. I was trying to connect with him. I wanted to take something of his always to have with me instead of that being a moment of love, because he was insecure about the reality of life and death. He couldn't hold space for a little girl. So the best he knew how to do was to shame me and shut me up. People who respond that way to talking about death probably aren't going to plan for the end of their life very well. They don't want to deal with that. They're in denial. Accept who your parents were, who they are today, and what is likely at the end of their lives. And be real with yourself about what you can help with, what you can control, and what you absolutely cannot. This may be a great time of having to offer yourself some real self-respect and some boundaries. We also may need to wait until people get worse before they will allow us to help. And that's just a part of how human beings work. If you have a prevention in your heart the way that I do, that may be a way that makes you maybe different than the average person out there. Number 10, boundaries. Boundaries, 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 boundaries. So most people get boundaries wrong, y'all. Boundaries are not, I'm going to wag my finger at you and I'm going to tell you where the line is and you better not cross it. Most of us who pursue boundaries work, we're going to do it wrong before we do it right. I did this too. I would look at my family members and I would declare the boundary. Please don't call me this name, or please do not speak to me about this person. I just want to have a relationship with you. And I had many family members who would look at me right in the face and step right over my line and look at me like, and what are you going to do about it now? Healthy boundaries are never, ever, ever constructed in a way that tries to control somebody else's behavior. You can make a request. Hey, I request that you not do that. And then you can honor your own boundary by leaving if they cross that line and stare at you. Boundaries are for you. Boundaries are what you can do. Hey, if you keep talking about that, I've asked you to stop. You don't want to. I don't want to hear it. So I'm going to take myself away. It's nuanced. It's balanced. It's not really about setting up any ultimatums. It's just about acting from self-respect, from a belief system of I'm in charge of my mind, my body. And if something doesn't feel good to me or right to me, it's on me, whether I sit in that energy or whether I back away from that energy. The idea that I'm going to control what somebody else is bringing, that doesn't work. So when you have healthy boundaries with people, hey, I'm going to come to the party, but I'm not going to be able to stay the whole time. I'm probably going to have to leave a bit early. It's not just about setting the boundaries for yourself or for the other person. It's also about testing out. Boundaries test for toxicity. So if I set a reasonable boundary like that about going to somebody's party, hey, I'm going to come, but I need to cut out a little early. I just wanted to let you know. Someone who's comfortable with boundaries goes, oh, okay, great. Thanks for coming and doing what you need to do. Know how busy everybody is? Thanks for spending some time with me. That person doesn't have control issues. That person isn't connected to using blame and shame, at least not in that moment, to try to control me to get what they want. That person who receives my boundary is super comfortable with me managing myself. That person probably has very reasonable boundaries too. Now, if I would have said this in my family of origin, I would have been met with, well, everybody else is staying overnight. Why not you? But this is what we do. Shame, blame. I might have been told, well, you're not allowed to do that. Everybody else is doing this, so you need to do this too. Differentiation, being different than everyone else in the family, is typically not allowed in toxic family systems. So when we set boundaries, when we try to have those conversations, the way someone is in the receiving of that communication tells us a lot about their healthiness level. So boundaries work takes understanding power struggle. Boundaries work is about understanding that it's on you to give yourself permission to matter, permission to step up and speak up, no matter how that boundary is received. And the way that it's received, you don't have to take that personally. You don't have to feel crushed by it, not even sad. You get to receive that tidbit of information and integrate it into your self-care. All right, somebody gives me pushback and shame when I have a boundary. I'm going to explain less and less and less, and I'm going to just do me. And for my inner child, if I'm going to be around that person, I'm going to prep my inner child by saying, hey, remember, this person gets a little nasty. They don't know any better. It's just the way they roll. And if and when that happens, we're just going to sidestep that. We don't have to care about that part. It's just what they do. It's a big part of self-care. It's a big part of taking care of yourself around people that have control issues. And that's the truth. Nobody's learning boundaries to deal with people that don't have control issues. We're learning boundaries to deal with people that feel a sense of entitlement to overly control us. Therefore, when we control ourselves with our own boundaries, they look at us and go, who do you think you are? How dare you? Shame, shame on you. You're not allowed. So the permission has to come from you. You are worthy of boundaries. You're worthy of the testing that happens when you grow into boundaries. As you listen to my work, this episode and others, if you're realizing that your body is feeling a tension more of the time than not, that your mind runs around in the past or the future more than in the present moment, then you are specifically invited to join the Peace Course. It starts on the 1st. Another group will go through together on the 1st, and these are 30 days, 30 little, mini, easy to digest techniques, strategies, activities, experiences that are designed for you to enjoy, for you to really honestly have some fun with, so that you can bring more peace into your being. Peace in the body begets peace in the mind. Peace in the mind begets peace in the body. Peace is a very important ingredient. And if you don't know how to practice peace, please come take Emotional Strength Training 30 Days to Peace. Use code BADASS to save 30%. And if you are a part of our Patreon, you get that course for half price. There's nothing else like it that I am aware of out there in the world. You deserve peace and you deserve thriving. That's what this course is for. Come sign up today at emotionalbadass.com/peace. All patrons get a shout out on the show, and we are so grateful for our Patreon support. Y'all are really the backbone. I love that we have this little corner of the internet that is so drama-free and everybody gets to share how they're growing. I absolutely love it. So I want to thank Liv, Alicia, Patty, Keisha, Luna, Sharon, Misty, Michelle. I want to thank Terry and Julie, Jenny, Sabrina, Christina, Margot, Marty, and Pamela. Thank y'all so much for supporting my work, for helping the show continue to be produced and connected to people all over the world. The next live stream Q&A that you can come submit a question to for May is how to stop catastrophizing hardship. You are welcome to come ask any and all questions about your story, about mine. Anything that can be helpful is welcome. Emotional Badass is part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Light and love. I am an emotional badass. You are an emotional badass. And together, we are where moxie meets mindful. I'll see you right here next time for a brand new episode. Till then, Take care. Bye-bye.